welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each episode, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Rumi Ahmed about his great new book, Narratives of Islamic Legal Theory, which was published with Oxford University Press in 2012. How should one understand Islamic law outside of its application? And what happens when we think about religious jurisprudence theoretically? For medieval Muslim scholars, this was the field where one could enumerate the meaning and purpose of Islamic law. But to the uninitiated, these justifications for legal thinking are submerged in rote repetition of technical language and discourses. Luckily for us, Rumi Ahmed dives into the depths of various legal theory manuals to draw narrative understandings of Sharia to the surface. In this great new book, Ahmed examines two formative contemporaneous jurists from the Hanafi school of law to determine the relationship between law and ethics through legal discourses. He focuses on the nature and meaning of the Quran, the role of the Sunnah or the prophetic example, and the use of considered opinion in structuring legal boundaries. Ultimately, he views their positions not merely as academic debates over the minutiae of religious opinions and injunctions, but as ritual observance, which formulates a world as if it were ideal. In our conversation, we discuss abrogation, punishment, salvation, Abraham's sacrifice, hadith transmission, Piercean notions of abduction, religious law, stoning, adultery, the role of scholars, and contemporary calls for reform. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion. Welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Rumi Ahmed about this great new book, Narratives of Islamic Legal Theory, which was published with Oxford University Press in 2012. How you doing, Rumi?
Doing great, Christian. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Great, great book. You make a somewhat daunting and perhaps boring topic very interesting, very engaging. And I think you're doing really interesting things with the way you're kind of examining these texts, and something hopefully that a lot of other people can apply to their work.
Thanks. Kind of the idea. I saw something, you know, people generally are kind of intimidated by legal theory, and I was hoping to kind of reduce that intimidation factor.
Yeah, you even cracked some jokes in there, which is not always happening in academic books. So thank you for keeping it entertaining. Before we get into the content, perhaps you could kind of give us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in the study of religion, perhaps kind of influential mentors or scholars that you have been formative in your work and what you do.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. When I was younger, I was always kind of interested in religion, probably as an identity thing. I was raised in this outside of D.C. in a kind of rural-ish area, and I was one of the only Muslims in my school. And for some time, I was the only Muslim. And so being at the mosque and being around people who shared similar values, similar ideas, it was a big deal. And pretty early on, my older brother got me involved in Muslim Youth of North America, and I started getting really active in Islamic activism. And the war on Bosnia happened when I was very young, and the war in Kashmir, obviously. And I started getting interested in international affairs and what Muslims were doing all over the world. And as a self-righteous, pious young Muslim boy, the one thing that really disturbed me was whenever people would try to denigrate Islam. And the thing that really got me was when so-called Muslims in the academy would denigrate Islam and they would question the hadith and the Quran. I thought, I'll show them a thing or two. And so, I started studying Islam pretty heavily, and went to traditional schools of learning, started memorizing the Quran, and I really wanted to study in depth so that I could refute some of the claims that were being made about Islam, and also to try and put something forward, try and show everyone how great the Islamic tradition was. And it is great, but when I started studying, I quickly realized that things were a lot more complicated than I had thought they were. And you know, the Islamic tradition was far more vast than I initially imagined. And I noticed that there were a lot more voices than I had heard, that a lot of the assumptions that we hold today weren't held in the past. And there really wasn't much I knew to do with that, except that I started talking to a few professors. And strangely enough, I got led to, by a series of coincidences, this professor at the University of Virginia, Peter Oakes. And I talked to him about some of my ideas, and he said, you know what, you have something. I mean, something, you have some idea of that can be cultivated and grown. I don't know what he saw in me, but he saw something, and he encouraged me to apply to the University of Virginia. And so I was like, sure, why not? It can't hurt to apply. So I applied, and I got in, and I got a scholarship. And I was blown away that someone was going to pay me to go to school. So I said, sure, I'll do that, not really knowing what a PhD was. And I started studying. I started going to classes. I took classes with Professor Abdulaziz Sajjadina. And one thing that he really encouraged me to do, Professor Sajjadina did, was to leave all my biases behind and just try to read the text and see what it's saying to me. Try to take any agenda or preconception that I had out and just read the text and then tell him, what do the texts say? And so he sat me down for many hours and we would just go through it, and he would try and point out some of the anachronisms that I had that I was bringing to the text. And he was trying to highlight the multiple layers that the text could have. And at the same time, Peter Oakes, who is not an Islamicist but is a philosopher of Judaism, he would point me to texts on hermeneutics and tell me how I could use hermeneutical theories to bring even more meanings out of the text and more possibilities, and to recognize where I was coming into the text and where I was coming out, and to recognize that there is always a back and forth between the reader and the text itself, that the text doesn't really say anything beyond what I bring to it. Yet the text has something to say on its own, and there's this interplay. And I got to really enjoy reading primary text, and there was a joy to it. And one thing I think that I got from that was that the people who are writing, they're writing for some reason. They're writing out of some, call it joy, call it duty. They're not just writing for themselves or for historical posterity. And so it got me thinking, well, why are these people writing this stuff? What do they hope to gain out of it? And what do they want from me? And I started noticing that texts that I thought were very dry were actually really interesting. And I started noticing when authors were using sarcasm and when they were joking and when they were really deeply serious. And the layers upon layers of text just kind of keep me going up till today.
That's great. Can you give us a little background in how this particular project developed? What kind of sparked the interest in this, these texts you're using, and perhaps your approach?
Yeah, sure. Legal theory was kind of the crown jewel in classes that I had taken in Damascus, and I went through a course of study based on the Deoband model, and it was seen as like this tradition. And so I was always kind of drawn to it just because it was seen as such a great thing. When this particular project started off, the details of it started off actually when you and I were in Yemen. What was this, 7 years ago? Oh my God. It was 6-7 years ago. You and I were in Yemen together, and I stumbled into a bookstore and saw this big legal theory section. And so I started reading legal theory books. And what I noticed was there was something very interesting going on. These seemingly dry, unattainable texts were actually making an argument, and I wasn't sure what it was. And so I started studying legal theory to try and see what is really going on in these texts. And at the same time, I was, I guess, wondering about the purpose of Islamic law. Islamic law in modern times, the way that we talk about it, we tend to think of law as like a reified system, something that gets applied on the state level. And when a law is broken, there's a punishment, a physical, some kind of a penalty that you pay in the real world. And laws don't change except through court systems and through formal appeals. And this is not what was going on in the pre-modern period in the legal theory text that I was reading. They had a very different conception of law. It wasn't so much about social order. When you read the biographical texts, these jurists didn't have any hard power. They might have said that they had a lot of hard power, but they couldn't actually affect change. They didn't consider law to be something on the state level. It was something that applied to several parts of life, personal as well as social. And like, you know, a law for ablution, for instance, if you break that law, nothing's going to happen to you. You're not going to get punished or put in jail, especially if no one else really knows. And if you decide to come up with a different law, that's okay. People might disagree with it, but it's not like you're committing treason. So Islamic law operated in some kind of a different sphere that I was trying to figure out what, you know, what is going on. And what I realized and what I hoped to bring out in the book was that actually Islamic law is operates within a religious framework. And the most important thing is not whether the law is applied in your daily life, but how the law works within your religious imagination. So it's not the case that law is supposed to be ordered to make a good society, but that law is supposed to get you to salvation. Law is supposed to get you to heaven. And so it's a tool that takes you from pure potential to felicity. Now, in order to do that, you have to come up with some worldview in which law plays a key part to get you from where you are to where you need to be. And that world doesn't operate on the same rules that regulate government or lived society, but it exists inside you, largely inside your imagination. So, for instance, if you want to talk about the Islamic law of cutting off the hands of the thief, if you believe that the hands of the thief should be cut off, it doesn't matter whether you actually cut off anyone's hand, but what matters is whether you believe that you should cut off people's hands when they steal something. That's the difference between salvation and damnation for you, whether you believe that God's law should be applied. And it's that should that's interesting for me. What should Islamic law look like, regardless of whether it's applied or not, regardless of how it looked in the past or what makes logical sense? What should it look like in order for us to gain salvation? And that's actually what I found happening in legal theory texts, that what they were doing was they were making these grand arguments about what law should look like. So the reason why that's not apparent in legal theory texts is because this works within a religious framework. Like, you don't have people in legal theory work saying, you know what Islamic law should look like? It should look like this. Instead, you have these really dense texts that talk about things like the nature of metaphor and general and specific commands. Like, if there's a command in the Quran, how do you know whether it's meant for everyone for all times or whether it's meant for one specific person or one specific time? And then these legal theory manuals, they go through all these details and arguments about very small minutiae of Islamic law. But what they're really doing when you put all of this together is that they're constructing a world in which Islamic law should work to get you to salvation. It's just really difficult to get to that. And the reason it's difficult is because it's religious. Religious rhetoric has to operate in this strange paradox where it has to appear like your religious rhetoric is really old and it's rooted in this ancient tradition and it doesn't change. And at the same time, your religious rhetoric has to be dynamic and it has to change or it has to adapt to address every single new issue that comes up. So on the one hand, it has to be really old and unchanging. On the other hand, it needs to be dynamic and applicable to all parts of life that maybe were never considered in the past. So in order to come up with a worldview, whether it's new, whether it's old, you have to present it as if it's old, as if, you know, this is the most natural thing in the world. And through that old rhetoric, you have to be dynamic and change things through the rhetoric of ancientness. And this is just the way that religious change, religious ideas seem to work, at a kind of simplified level. Qasim Zaman, he writes about how Islamic law changed in South Asia after colonialism. And, you know, things were so different with the colonial enterprise. And a lot of people said, you know what, Islamic law has to change and we have to modernize it. And those people who did that, who said, yeah, we need to rethink Islamic law, they lost credibility amongst the people. They're like, well, that's not religion. Religion is old. Religion is came down with the prophet, and we've been practicing religion since then the same way. Meanwhile, there was a group of scholars who just changed a bunch of stuff. Like, they saw that the laws weren't working, and they just said, okay, well, here are the new laws. Except that when they changed the law, they said, yeah, this is how it's always been. And because they changed the law while saying, this is how it's always been, they maintain credibility amongst the Muslim community. And that's the way that these legal theory texts are written. They're written in a way to present themselves as unchanging, as authoritative and applicable forever. Whereas the arguments that they're making about the way that law should work in an ideal sense are widely varied and creative and different, and they reflect different religious imaginations of how Islamic law should work to get you to salvation. And so really, through the language of legal theory, you can make an innumerable number of arguments about how Islamic law should work, and it's really only limited by your imagination.
Yeah, I think you're really successful in demonstrating kind of notions of tradition with a capital T and kind of the back and forth within certain boundaries of a given tradition. And I think anybody studying any religious tradition will, if they're interested in that kind of back and forth, will benefit from reading this. And you do this in the kind of context of what you're calling justification, right? That these texts are justifying the meaning and the purpose of Islamic law. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, you frame in the early part of the book that you're looking at these texts in through a Peircean notion of what you call abduction, right? I'm wondering if you can talk about what exactly does this mean, and then how does this help us understand Islamic legal theory?
Sure. So this notion of old and dynamic comes, static and dynamic tension comes into play here, because what legal theories claim to be doing was one of two things. They were either claiming to use deductive logic, where you take a source that's unimpeachable and you take a premise and you derive a conclusion from that. So it's very logical. So you start from some larger principle and then you derive an injunction. So it's teaching you, legal theory manuals are teaching you how to derive new injunctions that deal with new situations. Or the other thing that some legal theory manuals claim to do is they claim to use induction. So they say, here's a law that is on the books. How do we induce a principle and that we can then use to derive new laws? Legal theory manuals don't do either of those two things. They claim to, but they don't. What they really do is they take principles that are enshrined in their traditions and they take injunctions that are enshrined in their traditions as starting points. So it's not that they're deriving injunctions or deducing injunctions or inducing principles. They already have their principles and their injunctions set. They're not going to change. But what they do is they do something called abduction. They abduce or make a hypothesis about what you're supposed to do with those principles and injunctions. How are those principles and injunctions supposed to be applied, or how should they work in an ideal world? So it's neither induction nor is it deduction. So, for instance, the main sources of Islamic law are always going to be the two main sources, the Quran and the practice of Muhammad, the Sunnah. Those are never, ever going to change. Different legal schools might have different ideas about how the Quran works or how the Sunnah works. How do you access the Sunnah? For the most part, those don't change either within the legal school. Legal schools have certain injunctions that are central to their legal school. And for the most part, those injunctions don't change. How do you wash before prayer? How do you hold your hands while you pray? What is the punishment for failing to pay your zakat tax on time? These things are generally fixed. And if you look at jurisprudence manuals throughout the centuries, there's not a lot of change. There is change, and it's very interesting when that change occurs. But for the most part, say 80% of things are pretty much static. So the principles don't change. The injunctions don't change. But what you do with that, it changes significantly. So, for instance, the law of fornication, for instance, or the law of adultery, a zina. The Quran says that the punishment for zina, if four people witness the act of adultery, the punishment is to be stoned to death. The hadith state that the punishment is for, the Quran states that the person is supposed to be flogged. So the person is supposed to be lashed 100 times. The hadith, however, states that the person is supposed to be stoned to death. And there are several hadith that make it sound like Muhammad was uncomfortable with either stoning or lashing and made excuses for people who committed adultery. Now, the fact is, despite the fact that the Quran says lashing, some hadith say stoning, and the general ethos of the prophetic model was to be wary of any kind of corporal punishment, every legal manual will say the punishment for adultery is stoning. So that's fixed. It's not going to change in pre-modern legal theories. But what I wanted to show in this book was that the principles and injunctions that appeared fixed do not limit how the law is applied. The only thing that limits how the law is applied is imagination. So let's say, for instance, that one imagines Islamic law to work in an imitative fashion. So what is the purpose of Islamic law? How do I imagine how Islamic law is supposed to work? Well, one thing is to say Muhammad was a prophet inspired by God. Therefore, whatever he did should be imitated by all Muslims in all times and all places, and that will get you to salvation. So the model that he created in Medina should be replicated, and in Cairo, and in Baghdad, and in New York, or wherever. If you want to get to salvation, you should imitate the prophet as much as humanly possible. But another model that you can imagine is the prophet was sent by God as an example for all of mankind. Therefore, humans should try to emulate the prophetic model wherever they are. And that might look different in different places. There's a difference between imitation and emulation. Are you supposed to recreate the prophetic actions, or are you supposed to base your actions on the prophetic paradigm? That determines then how you apply that particular injunction. So I'll give you an example. There's no legal theory work, by the way, will say, yeah, you're supposed to emulate him or you're supposed to imitate him. Instead, they make very subtle arguments about technical terms that then determine how you imagine the law to work. So for instance, there's a part of my book when I talk about the Quran, and there's this issue of abrogation, that some verses in the Quran abrogate others. There are certain verses of the Quran that talk about, for instance, making a bequest to people when you die. So you should write out to whom are you giving all of your money to. But there's another verse in the Quran that divides up your assets very particularly after you die. So which one is it? Are you supposed to make bequests, or are you supposed to divide up your money, you know, based on this particular model? Well, most scholars will say you have to follow the particular model and divide up your assets according to the percentages mentioned in the verse that talks about percentages. But then this brings into question God and God's wisdom. So if one verse of the Quran can abrogate another verse of the Quran, does that mean that God changed his mind? And does that mean that following the original verse of the Quran would make you a bad person? Like, how can you be bad if you're following a verse of the Quran that comes up earlier? So can God command things that are bad and then change his mind and then command something that's good? So when legal theorists talk about this, talk about the issue of abrogation, they'll bring up some of these ideas very quickly. And the example that most legal theorists give to talk about how God might be seen as either changing his mind or not is the story of Abraham sacrificing his son. So in the Quran, there's this story. It's a slight variation of the biblical story where Abraham has a dream. And in the dream, he's told to sacrifice his son. The son is unnamed. So he goes to his son and he says, I had this dream. And the son says, well, do as God commanded you. And so he says, okay. He starts going up to the mountain to sacrifice his son. And just before he's about to kill his son, God sends down a ram that he's supposed to sacrifice in the son's stead. Now, what happened? In the story, God commanded Abraham to do something through a dream. And then Abraham set out to do that thing. And then God said, no, don't do the command that I told you to do. Instead, do this other command. So the command to sacrifice the ram abrogated the command to sacrifice the son. But it brings up all these questions about whether God can command something evil. Was it the case that that killing the son would have been a good thing if God hadn't abrogated the command? And if it was a bad thing, how could God command it? If it was a good thing, why did God change his mind? So now killing a son would be bad, and killing a ram is good, or killing a lamb or some other kind of sacrifice is a good thing. How does all of this work? Does God's command have a certain temporality? Like, did his command last until a certain point and then it expired, and so he sent down another command? So they talk about all these things. And the two scholars that I look at in particular, they both looked at this situation. I want to digress just a bit to talk about the two scholars. To show how the religious imagination works, I particularly chose two scholars who lived in the same century, around the same area, who had similar teachers, and were both part of the same legal school. They both agreed on the same principles and the same injunctions. And so you would think that their legal theory manuals would look exactly the same. And in fact, they're ordered in almost the same way. And if you took a quick read of them, they would look exactly the same. But when you look closely, you see that what they're actually doing is making hugely different arguments about the way that Islamic law is supposed to work in an ideal world to get you to salvation. So one of the scholars, Dabusi, he looked at this this story. And he said, okay, well, what was God doing here? So what he was doing was he was trying to bring out his purpose, God's wisdom, And the purpose that of this test was to get Abraham closer to God. So the actual details of the command are not important. What is important was getting Abraham closer to God. And as soon as he tried to get closer to God, the command was fulfilled. So you don't actually have to go through with sacrificing the son. You could just, as soon as he tried, that's it. He got closer to God, end of story. Sarachsi looked at the same story and he said, no, it's not purpose. And he didn't say, no, it's not purpose. But instead he used a different word. And he said, well, what it is it's really God had an objective. And the objective was to see whether Abraham wanted to fulfill the command. If he wanted to fulfill the command, then he would have passed the test. And God had to stop him. So now we have two models of what was happening. In one, God had a purpose, and the purpose was to bring Abraham closer to God. Doesn't matter whether he did it or not. As long as he got closer to God, you're good to go. In the other one, he wanted to see if Abraham wanted to do the command. Now, how does all of this relate to stoning adulterers? Well, Debussy said, okay, so if the purpose of Islamic law is to get someone closer to God, then the punishment for adultery is still stoning, but the judge should think about whether or not stoning the adulterers will fulfill the purpose of bringing people closer to God. If it serves any other purpose than getting people closer to God, then the judge shouldn't do it because it doesn't fulfill the purpose of the law. The judge should come up with some other kind of idea, and it doesn't make the judge sinful. It just makes the judge, it actually brings the judge closer to God by thinking about whether it's fulfilling the purpose. And if some other purpose might get people closer to God, then they should do that. Sarachsi, on the other hand, since he believed that the point of the test of Abraham was to see if he wanted to do it, a judge, in order to get closer to God, should want to stone the adulterers. The judge should try to, as little as possible, to be swayed by emotion and should try and institute the punishment. And in fact, I have an extended quote in there in one of the footnotes. It's like, great, from Sarachsi's Jurisprudence, so a different book, where he writes about how the jurist should not let passion sway him, or feelings of guilt or sadness or remorse or compassion sway the judge from wanting to fulfill the command. If something happens, like the judge can't fulfill the command for some reason, that's okay. But the judge should want to in order to pass the test. And the extended quote is you shouldn't try and make excuses for people who commit adultery. Like if someone says, I was compelled, well, maybe that worked for a woman, but not for a guy. Because a guy could always complain to someone higher and say, so-and-so is compelling me, please stop them. And, guys tend to be, if a guy had sex, that means that at some point he really wanted it. So he comes up with these elaborate theories that justified the idea that the judge shouldn't be swayed, because the point of the test of Abraham was to get was to see if you would want to fulfill the law. Now that this thing about Abraham happens in maybe a paragraph or two, and the difference in the approach of Debussy and Sarachsi is with one word, purpose, as opposed to objective. But the way that they define that word changes vastly the way that Islamic law is applied. And so in one case, the judge takes circumstance into account and tries to and can think of ways to get the people to not apply the law. And in the other case, the judge has to want to apply the law as much as possible, unless there is some impediment that's keeping the judge from doing so. These are completely different visions of Islamic law, of how Islamic law is supposed to get you to salvation. And the society that would be built on these visions is completely different. As you go through, I divided the chapter the chapters into the main sources of Islamic law, the Quran, the Sunnah, prophetic practice, and opinion. And I tried to show how these two scholars used the exact same terms, the same discourse, that made it appear that these legal theory manuals are in a long tradition and they're not doing anything really all that special. They used them to make completely different arguments about the way that the law should be applied. They weren't upsetting principles or changing any injunctions, but they were changing the entire vision of Islam. And, you know, particularly for reformists today and those who are thinking of how Islamic law is supposed to work in the modern world, I feel that this is highly instructive. We find that today the same paradox exists in Muslim communities based on several surveys that have been done. Muslims tend to believe at the same time, Muslims in Muslim countries tend to believe at the same time that Islamic law is ancient and should not change, and yet it is dynamic and it can address every new circumstance. There is a language to Islamic reform, to Islamic legal theory, and to change in the Islamic world that struggles between reforming all the laws and maintaining credibility amongst those who follow Islam and want to live in dignity as dignified Muslims, believing that they're part of a long and ancient tradition, and yet are fully citizens of the modern world where there's as little as possible cognitive dissonance between the modern values that we hold and the Islamic law that we see getting from our modern situation to salvation.
That's great, Rumi. Thank you. In this first chapter, you focus on the Quran as a source. You move on then to the Hadith and how this plays structuring ideas about the Sunnah and how the Sunnah structures normative practice. And one of the areas where this kind of push and pull between these two authors can be seen is in different types of Hadith transmission. Can you talk a little bit about the various types of transmission and how these two authors effectively demonstrated their position on Islamic law more generally through that idea?
Yeah, certainly. So there are different when using the Hadith as a source of the Sunnah. I mean, the Sunnah is, everyone would agree that prophetic practice is a source of law. The question is, how do you know what that prophetic practice is? So most all Muslim scholars would agree that there is a such thing as heavily attested statements of Muhammad, of things that he did, so heavily attested that it's almost impossible that they could be forged. So, you know, if one or two people said it, okay, fine. But when a whole bunch of people say it, and all these people are all over the Muslim empire saying this thing, chances are there's some truth to it. And you can rely on it as an effective means of accessing the Sunnah. So there's this transmission of what people say Muhammad did probably has some veracity to it. But then how do you know whether or not lots of people said it? Like, what is lots of people? Like, is it three? Is it four? Is it 10? Is it 50? And really, at the point where it's 50, there's no way that it would be the exact same saying. So 50 people maybe have the spirit of something Muhammad said. Like, does that count as prophetic practice? And so these are the things that that Muslim scholars debated over the centuries. And they would also debate, well, okay, whatever was said by a lot of people, that's not – these reports aren't high in number. So there aren't a whole bunch of statements that a whole bunch of people said. Most statements are what are known as the khabar wahid, the singular transmissions. Someone, you know, 150 years after Muhammad died, said that someone else said that someone else said that someone else said that someone else said that Muhammad said such and such and such. Now, that's a lot of layers where something could have gone wrong. The problem is, if you cut out the single transmissions, you lose a lot of authority for Islamic law. Most of Islamic law is built upon single transmissions. And so if you accept a lot of single transmissions, then you can have a more authoritative base for Islamic law. And if you accept less single transmissions, then you can accept less. Obviously, you would have less of an authoritative basis on which to formulate Islamic law. Now, at the point where my two authors are writing, Babusi and Sarakhsi, the school that they belong to, the Hanafi school, is set. They accept multiple chain transmissions, mutawatir. They accept single transmissions, and much of their law is built upon single transmissions. So there's going to be no debate on whether or not you can accept single transmissions or whether there's a such thing as well-attested transmissions. But you can play around a little bit with the definitions of these terms. So Sarakhsi, without putting a number on multiple chain transmissions, seems to suggest that you can, somewhere around 3 to 10 people, that counts. Whereas the Busi, without stating a number, is somewhat on the higher range. And you can start to see that the Busi is a little more dubious of transmissions than is Sarakhsi, even though he's using the same terms and he's accepting the same terms. Now, there's a really interesting turn where the Busi and Sarakhsi start talking about what differentiates a well-attested transmission from a singular transmission, and what can you do with these things. So both of them agreed you can't be sure about single transmissions. Like if you only heard something from one chain, it might be completely wrong. Like it might be made up. So the Busi says, well, you can accept them and you can base your law on them, but always know that it could be wrong. So, a different transmission could come that could knock everything you think on its feet. And, you're never quite sure of the law that you derive. So he keeps all the injunctions that are based on single transmissions. He keeps the principle that you accept single transmission, but he adds a little bit of doubt into it. And he says, well, we never quite know. And so what that does is, if Islamic law is built almost entirely on single transmissions, then you're not always sure about whether you're applying the law correctly or not. Whereas Sarakhsi, he said, yeah, same thing. We don't know that the single transmissions are true. They don't generate indubitable knowledge. You can't be sure that what's in them is right. But the fact is, and so he works the other way, he says the fact is we get our knowledge through single transmissions. And this was the way that Muhammad worked. He sent out emissaries to different parts of the Muslim community to go out and give the message of Islam. Those were single people. So on some level, you have to be able to trust single transmissions a little more. And you know how you can really tell if a single transmission is right is if it accords with the injunctions that you have on the books. It means that the scholars felt that certain injunctions were better than others. And you should follow those scholars because those scholars know what they're talking about. So now we start to see two different models of how humans should engage Islamic law. One is, with the Busi's cases, you're a little dubious of it, but it's kind of a necessary thing in order for you to get salvation, and you try the best you can. In the other, in Sarakhsi's model, you have this hierarchy of scholars that people should go to in order to know which single transmissions are right and how they're supposed to derive their Islamic law. And the scholars will know. They'll be able to tell you whether a single transmission is right or not, because they know the injunctions that have already been derived from them. And so they can tell you which transmissions you should follow and which you can't. And when you see things like that in single transmissions and the Sunnah and the Quran, you start to see patterns in the way that the Busi and Sarakhsi approach Islamic law. So for instance, the issue of taqlid, which I address in the third chapter of, what are people supposed to do in their daily lives? The Busi said, you can follow, pretty much anyone, any scholar, and the scholar might be right, scholar might be wrong. The point of Islamic law for you to gain salvation is not to necessarily do the right thing, but to try to do the right thing. And as long as you try, God will forgive you. Whereas Sarrazy says, no, you could get this very wrong. And laypersons, they don't know what the injunctions are. They don't know how to sift through the singular transmissions. They need to follow someone. They need to follow people who are what he defines as the scholarly community. And very quickly, he says the scholarly community is the majority of scholars in any one legal school. And so whereas in the Busi's conception, you can just follow, your local imam and you try to do the right thing. In Sarrazy's conception, it's far more immediate, and you can't just follow anybody. You need to follow the majority. And if you deviate from the majority, even if you think you're doing the right thing, you could be making God angry because you're doing something that's potentially shady, but that's potentially wrong. And if you do something that's wrong, then God will be angry with you. So again, these are idealized conceptions of the way that Islamic law should work, regardless of the way that it does work. I mean, the fact is most Muslims didn't know very much about Islamic law at all, and they didn't go toward their scholars and ask them every little question. But how should it work for you to gain salvation? I call this subjunctive realities. They're describing the world as if the world worked according to a particular logic. How would our daily actions look? How would God want us to act? And that's the spirit in which they seem to be writing these texts.
Yeah, that's great. The book goes into great detail, and we obviously don't have time to go through all the examples that you do in the book. But one of the things I wanted to make sure to ask you is, in a conclusion, you kind of reflect on this idea of this is just kind of does not have real kind of lived effects, then what exactly is the purpose of writing these types of texts? And you basically come to the conclusion that legal theory it can be understood as ritual.
Yeah.
Could you kind of explain that?
Sure. So, I mean, one thing we know is that the scholars didn't have a lot of hard power. Sometimes there would be a scholar would be part of the court. But even still, whenever a scholar got into an argument or a disagreement with some local ruler or anyone with any kind of power, the scholars always lost. The stories are multiple throughout the biographical dictionaries of scholars who go to jail for seemingly minor offenses because they got somebody angry. The scholars never had the final say on what's supposed to happen. I mean, Sarrazy, for instance, one of my scholars, he criticized his local leader. I mean, not even the sultan of the empire in which he belonged, but just a local Khan, a local leader. He criticized the way that he contracted his marriage. And then he spent the next 10 to 12 years in an underground dungeon because the Khan didn't like the fact that he was questioning his marriage. The scholars had to have known. They knew that they weren't affecting actual change, that no judge or no ruler was going to rule based on their legal theory book. So the question I came to is, well, why are they writing it in the first place? I mean, this is all very interesting. They have this religious imagination that they're putting across through this legal theory book to try to describe how people should attain salvation. Well, who are they writing to? What do they hope to happen? Well, maybe they're writing to their contemporaries. Maybe they're trying to affect the way that other scholars think about Islamic law. But then what? Those scholars don't have the power to affect jurisprudence and to make the empire run on Islamic law, whatever that might mean. And those scholars often weren't judges, so they couldn't affect things in the real world. So what is going on? And what is going on is that Islamic law is Islamic. It's a religious practice. And so when they're writing these texts, they're reflecting their devotion to God. They are themselves trying to get to heaven. They're trying to explain how salvation works. And when they're writing these texts, it's an act of ritual. So when you're doing a ritual, it doesn't matter that you're not affecting change in the real world. When a Muslim goes into a mosque and starts praying, or a Jew goes into a synagogue, or a Christian goes into a church, or whatever have you, when you begin a ritual, you are purposely circumscribing a space around yourself that doesn't exist outside of that ritual. You're blocking off the world, and you're creating a subjunctive world for yourself, as if the ritual were a reflection of your daily life or the way that the world should work. So whether you're praying or you're giving a charity or you're making a pilgrimage to somewhere else, these are not things that exist in your daily life. You are creating a subjunctive universe for yourself as if this were reality, as if this reflected God's desire for you. And that's what I see going on in these texts, is they're making ritual, they're engaging in a ritual that reflects their devotion to God, much the same way that people pray. And yes, they're doing other things with it. They're writing to other scholars. They're making a name for themselves by publishing books. They're gathering students. But at its heart, the reason why someone would write a book like this and seemingly hide a lot of their revolutionary ideas inside ancient language is because their main concern is with God and with the ritual of writing these legal theory texts. And I think that this ritual supersedes legal theory. I mean, it just happens to be so obvious in legal theory because it's so theoretical. You can kind of look at jurisprudence and say, okay, well, they want people to do X, Y, or Z. But there's not a lot of commanding in legal theory texts. It seems to be more about hermeneutics. And so it's just more obvious in the legal theory text, but works of jurisprudence, if they're not going to be applied on a state level, it's a ritual that jurists are engaging in to reflect their devotion to God. And they are also constructing an as-if universe, as if Islamic law applied at all levels and people would gain salvation through their action. And that's still how Islamic law works today. Yes, we have state systems now, and we have nation-state conceptions of law. But at the everyday, people engage with or engage in Islamic law as a ritual means of communing with God. And the different ways that people do that are only limited by the imagination that they bring to it. There are lots of Muslims who don't practice at all. They don't practice Islamic law at all, but they think it's really, really important. And they say that you should practice Islamic law. And whether they do or they don't is of secondary concern. What matters for them is what they believe and what Islamic law means for them in their lives. And when we start thinking about law as a ritual, I think we start to get a much denser picture of how people interact with religion and with law, and religious law in particular, in their everyday lives. And that there is a rhetoric, there's a way to talk about religion in a way that's different that we talk about state law, civil law, criminal law, that has deeper stakes and many more ways to practice this type of law than what we may be used to thinking of.
Yeah, it's great. And it's really an excellent book, Rumi. You've spent a lot of time with us, so I don't want to take too much more of your time. But we would love to hear more about kind of what you're working on now, perhaps other projects that you have maybe that are coming out soon, or what can we expect from Rumi Ahmed in the future?
Yeah, well, the next major work is an extension of this in the realm of jurisprudence, to describe how Islamic law changes and how it can change particular injunctions while working within the rhetoric of an Islamic law that doesn't change. And so what I'm trying to do is to give an overview of historically how did Islamic law work. Today, how does Islamic law work slightly differently in modern conceptions? And how does the logic of Islamic law and Islamic legal reform still work? So there are lots of things, there are lots of injunctions that have changed in the last 100 years, in the last 50 years. And there are lots of calls for changing Islamic laws. Some of those calls are very effective, and Islamic law changes as a result. Some of those calls are not so effective, and they get a very impassioned, vehement pushback from legal scholars, Islamic legal scholars and traditional institutions of learning. And so my main question is, why is it that some calls get taken up and some calls get rejected? And the answer is manyfold, but part of it is the way that the arguments are made. There are lots of calls for changing Islamic law because Islamic law doesn't the inherited Islamic law works against modern conceptions of justice. And so Islamic law should then be changed in order to fit modern conceptions. And traditional legal scholars push back on that very hard. And their response is glib, and it offhandedly dismisses real concerns. They say, you know, justice is not a methodology, or morality is not a methodology. You need some methodology. And then, but then, you know, if you ask them, well, what methodology do they have? You often don't really get a response other than, well, it's in the tradition. So what my project is what if we took the criticism seriously and we said, okay, how would we make a methodology for reforming Islamic laws upon which there is some pushback from legal scholars? How do we make it so that these reforms appear more palatable methodologically? And what I'm trying to do is to outline a method of reform, a theology of reform that that balances competing concerns that traditional legal scholars might have. And the fact is that Islamic law changes and has changed dramatically to fit modern or to fit different conceptions of morality. Slavery is no longer considered acceptable. Concubinage is no longer an acceptable idea, whereas in the pre-modern past, it was perfectly acceptable. So some things can change and can get adopted into traditional legal discourses. And I'm trying to describe how most any change, no longer cutting off the hands of the thief, not stoning adulterers, not prosecuting any sexual crimes whatsoever, or personal sexuality as a crime. How do moral values that people might hold get translated through a methodologically rigorous ethical discourse into injunctions that can then be taken seriously and debated inside traditional legal circles?
That's great. Yeah, we look forward to that, Rumi. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks again for making the time to chat with us about the book. Again, it's a great book. I think people in various fields are going to benefit from it greatly. So thank you.
Thanks very much. It's always great to talk to you, Christian.
You've been listening to my conversation with Rumi Ahmed about his book, Narratives of Islamic Legal Theory, which was published with Oxford University Press in 2012. Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion.